This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Chiara Bonacci about heritage and nationalism, understanding populism through big data. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. This is a fascinating book for lots of different reasons. It's methodologically really interesting. The points it makes about, as the title says, the relationship between heritage and nationalism, I think, are incredibly sort of well-timed and you know, speak to the current moment. But at the same time, it's actually just kind of really interesting in terms of some of the reflections it's got on things like the Roman Empire, you know, mythologies around walls and, you know, ideas about Italianness or Romanness and things like this. So that there's a collection of really sort of fascinating things that the book does, as well as being, I think, quite an important academic text as well. And I guess the place to start with is the research project that the book kind of draws from and sort of develops, which is this project that was called Ancient Identities in Modern Britain. And I wonder if you could say a bit about kind of how that project led you to write this book.
Yes, of course. In 2016, I was awarded these grants from the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council to work on a project called Ancient Identities in Modern Britain. And this was together with colleagues at Durham University. We were very excited about this project. We wanted to really examine how different people in England, Scotland, and Wales experience and value the Iron Age and Roman past, potentially in different ways, through interactions with people, objects, and places from these periods online and offline. And of course, when we started the project, Brexit came. And that was a big deal, as we all know. And I remember starting to work on the project and coming across satirical pages on Facebook that we're really talking about Brexit through references to the ancient past. You know, images of Celts and texts saying it's time that Britain leaves this Roman Empire, referring to the European Union. So at that point, the idea came to develop a strand of this research that was looking specifically at how people leverage the Iron Age Roman and early medieval past to discuss political issues in the present, and particularly how they use it when they want to support or oppose populist, nationalist discourse.
I mean, we should probably talk a little bit about those two terms, really, populism and populist nationalism, because you know, they really matter in terms of the core story the book tells, and as you mentioned, you know, the kind of events that you lived through and gave rise really to the things the book is interested in. So what are we talking about here? What do these terms mean, or what are the kind of practices associated with these terms?
Yes, populism and nationalism are two huge concepts. There are rivers of literature that have been written to discuss what they are, but the book refers specifically to populist nationalism by drawing on the work of the sociologist Brubaker, and also by drawing on Christian Fuchs' work, particularly a really interesting book that he wrote and published in 2018 called Nationalism 2.0. So populist nationalism in the book is understood as that kind of sentiment and discourse that works to exclude specific groups of people. You could say both horizontally and vertically. Vertically, because it creates divisions between us, the people, and them, the elite. But also horizontally, for example, because it excludes outgroups on the basis of things like religion or culture, ethnicity, etc. Fox, in particular, says that nationalism in the age of networked web infrastructures, in the age of neoliberalism and globalization, is fundamentally populist. It has cultural, economic, and political dimensions, and it divides between and creates divisions between in-groups and out-groups in order to defend what he calls the idea of our country, our economy, and our way of life.
You sort of hinted at this already, that sense of, like, you know, defending our country, our economy, our way of life, at first would seem to be sort of kind of removed from classical civilization and, you know, kind of discussions of the historiography of Rome and stuff like this. But actually, they're really kind of deeply intertwined in both, as you say, the kind of in-group and out-group dynamics and the kind of the building of what our, you know, society is. And I wonder if you could kind of sketch out, you know, you'd mentioned a couple of times that references to things like Rome and the Roman Empire in Brexit. But what is the sort of relationship between populist nationalism and then heritage and archaeology?
Yes, so as I was saying, a lot of this populist nationalist discourse is characterized by demarcations between in-groups and out-groups, an inside and an outside. And an outside that is seen antagonistically. The way in which we often experience and frame the past in contemporary society is also through oppositions. We often oppose one period to the period that came first or to the period that came afterwards. And these oppositions are used to inform inside outside demarcations that we find in populist nationalist discourse. So we have ideas of us and others that are strongly influenced by what we identify as our origins. They can be constructed through processes of identification, for example, with either the Romans or the barbarians, native Iron Age tribes or Germanic people. And whenever one of these collectives is invoked, mentioned, this is done in order to refer to specific sets of values that that specific collective symbolizes. And these values can vary very much from one person to another. And often they can vary also within the same individual conscience. So in essence, the past is very relevant to this discourse because oppositions between different periods and the values that they symbolize are used to fuel inside-outside demarcations that we find in populist nationalist discourse.
We're going to hear a bit more about those when we do the kind of core case studies of the book from Italy, Britain and the US as well. But before that, the kind of the other big thing going on with the book is methods and this idea of not just kind of digital heritage, but digital methods to engage with, you know, these, as you've sketched out, you know, really important contemporary debates about heritage, archaeology and the past. And I wonder, I guess kind of like not just what were the methods, you know, what kind of big data approaches did you use, but also kind of why were you interested, or, you know, why was kind of, you know, digital approaches that the right sort of or set of methods for you to get into these tricky questions about populist nationalism in the past?
Big data approaches in heritage, and particularly to look at heritage experiences and heritage values, have not been used very much up to now. And this is partly because very often heritage researchers tend to have a background in the humanities and tend to lean towards more qualitative approaches. But for this specific study, it was really important to integrate more qualitative kinds of analysis, content analysis, with data-intensive kinds of analysis that drew on large volumes of big data. So it's in total about 60 million data points were analyzed. And why? Well, because by looking at social media data at scale in these quantities, it was possible to find those rare occurrences when people talk about the present, talk about their political ideas by referencing the past. And those rare occurrences, when they do these spontaneously without being questioned and specifically asked, as you would in a survey, for example. And this was really important in order to inform the kind of study, the kind of research that I wanted to undertake. There is also another reason. Social media are very much the spaces where populist nationalist discourse is expressed. Of course, not the only spaces where you can find it, but spaces where you can indeed find it. And this is because there are spaces where politicians, political parties can voice this kind of discourse and people can respond. They can voice their concerns, what they feel is oppressing them, the kind of political futures they hope to see happening. And politicians, again, can respond to grievances. They can respond to whatever large numbers of people are expressing on their pages. As Gerbaudo, a sociologist, says, there is almost an elective affinity, you could say, between social media and populism for this reason.
So how does it work, this, as you say, you know, relationship, this sort of elective affinity and these platforms? You've got these three kind of case studies, which are sort of similar but different and have different kind of dynamics before the book sort of later turns, I guess, to a broader reflection about the meaning of these case studies. So if we start with Italy and the 2018 Italian election, this sounds kind of flippant, but it's like you'd sort of expect things like the Roman Empire to sort of be, you know, possibly used by right-wing or, you know, Italian populist parties, you know, because at least there is, I suppose, that national history there. But as you kind of get into it in the book, there are very specific things that come through. You know, it's not a discussion of the history of Italy. It's a discussion of things like, you know, Roman imperialism, these kind of like mythical heroic figures. And as you've mentioned earlier, lots of in-group and out-group, lots of kind of border drawing. So what was going on with the Italian use of heritage for populist reasons?
The Italian case study was very interesting because what came out of the 2018 election was effectively a coalition government that governing together the League, the Northern League, and the Five Star Movement, which were at the time could be defined as two populists and Eurosceptic parties. One more techno-populist and post-ideological, the Five Star Movement, and the other more strongly conservative, more right-wing, the League. So what was possible to see? First of all, I analysed both the ways in which the Iron Age, Roman and early medieval past were leveraged by these parties and their leading politicians. And then I looked at how they were leveraged by their base, so by those who were posting on their public Facebook pages. And what I could see is that in the majority of cases, they were supporting the narratives put forward by the two parties and leading politicians I mentioned. And what was possible to see is that the official Facebook pages of the League and the Five Star Movement and the Facebook discourse of their leaders, so Matteo Salvini and Beppe Grillo, made a very thin use of heritage. So they don't really refer to specific aspects of the Iron Age or the Roman periods. Something that should be said is that in 2013, the League ceased to be a party that was advocating for the separation of the north of Italy from the south. It was at that point in time that it started to be a nationalist party that wanted to appeal to a national electorate. So in terms of references to the past, in 2013, the League moved from a celebration of Celtic origins, free Celtic origins, to more civilizationalist narratives that linked Christian traditions with broad ideas of Italy's cultural and artistic greatness. And differently, the Five Star Movement defined itself as the national heritage. They presented the movement and their online platforms as mechanisms to shape the national heritage of Italy and any future legacies. So history was made in the now by this techno-populist party, and it was written on some sort of historical historical tabula rasa, so a clean slate. Very different is what happens and what we see with the people who commented on the official pages connected to the Five Step Movement and the League, because these people who, as I said, largely supported the leaders Salvini and Grillo and their parties, expressed populist nationalist discourse in ways that made much more specific references to pre-modern periods. The Roman world was generally given a great prominence, great importance compared to other periods. It featured mainly through references to the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was central to the crafting, the molding of four key oppositions. We see one between civilization and barbarism, one between military force and weakness, greatness and decadence, multiculturality and cultural homogeneity. And then these binaries, these oppositions, were used to shape, create myths of origin, of decline and collapse, and of resistance in a range of combinations. The League's base primarily leveraged the Roman Empire to stress a vertical division between indigenous and civilized us, and immigrant and barbaric others. Whereas, for example, comments from sympathizers of the Five Star Movement tended to revolve more around a separation between the people and the elite. So, for example, the Roman Empire was called to refer to the corruption of the current political elite that would lead to the collapse of Italy in the same way as the corruption, in their words, of the Roman elites led, again, in the minds, to the fall of the Roman Empire.
I mean, there's a lot of different strands to that analysis and the kind of themes, some of which, you know, complements each other, some of which is kind of contrasting. And later on in the book, you've got slightly different kind of examples for the British and the American case studies, but you've also got this continuation of these, you know, some contrasts and some kind of complementarities. And I wonder, what are the kind of comparisons between how heritage was used in the Brexit referendum, how Trump talked about walls? Like, the Trump chapter is really remarkable. There's a lot of stuff going on with the Trump chapter. But yeah, how are they kind of similar and how are they different in terms of the discourses and the reactions on social media as compared to the Italian case study?
Yeah, so the three case studies all have an underlying theme, which is that of border control and mobility. And this theme characterizes them all. In the Brexit chapter, I looked at the Facebook discourse of leading politicians and parties right before and after the Brexit referendum, and then I looked at about 360 public Facebook pages that talked about Brexit, that featured Brexit in the title, the description, and how the past was used in those pages. There are lots of things that could be said in terms of differences and similarities, but For example, what we can see in the British, in the Brexit case study, is that there is almost an opposite way of using the civilization barbarism binary that is centered on the Roman Empire. So in the Italian case study, you see an identification with the Roman Empire and them, the other, the antagonistically crafted other, is either other countries that are part of the European Union, because let's remember material I looked at tended to be Eurosceptic, so people that were using this kind of sort of myth of origin were expressing Eurosceptic positions. But in the Brexit chapter, we see that Eurosceptic positions are embraced by essentially identifying with either the free Iron Age people that came before the Roman Empire, or the post-Roman people who came after. And the Roman Empire is instead seen as a metaphor to express the domination, the oppression that Eurosceptics within the Brexit discourse associate with the European Union. So you see the binary, you see this civilization barbarism binary centered in the Roman Empire played out in opposite ways in these two case studies. There are also other similarities and differences related, for example, to the ways in which this past is leveraged, whether or not, for example, expert voices are mentioned. We see them more in the Italian case study, much more referenced there than we see in the Brexit case study. And Trump. Well, the Trump case study is quite it's quite interesting because as we know, the Roman past, the Iron Age past, have played historically an important, a significant role in the shaping of nationalist narratives in North America as well as in Europe. And there, what could be seen is that as soon as Trump declared his intent to build a great wall, the Trump's wall, a number of different media outlets started to talk about the effectiveness of war, the ancestry of war, the psychological nature of walls, and how they are effectively walls of worry. They have symbolic power, and they at the same time express people's worries and are a way in which politicians can project an idea of security. And this was done through a number of references and comparisons between Trump's wall and historical walls from the past. Hadrian's Wall was one, but also the Great Wall of China, which was also mentioned, by the way, by Trump himself when he was trying to make a case about the fact that this wall that he wanted to build was entirely feasible, because if the Great Wall of China could be built, then Trump's wall certainly could have been built. But also other walls, the Berlin Wall, the Maginot Line, so on and so forth. And something interesting that we see is that these, in most cases, these media outlets tend to actually take a quite a non-monolithic approach, let's say, to the to what the function of walls is in the past and the present, and they at least refer to more nuanced ways of understanding them. They don't present them uniquely as defensive ways, defensive structures and ways to protect an insight that worked effectively. But when you move to Twitter discourse and you see how people in part received some of these media discourse and in part simply developed discourse of their own, you see a much more binary way of talking about walls in the past and the present, and whether they were pro-walls or anti-walls, pro-Trump's wall, anti-Trump's wall, they tended to talk about the effectiveness of walls and to embrace much more, much less nuanced narratives around what the function of walls actually is.
You mentioned kind of just in passing the differences in how experts were invoked. And I'm fascinated by this because obviously in some ways nationalist populism is, you know, explicitly anti-expert. There's, you know, a sort of strand that says, you know, experts are part of the elite. And, you know, as you mentioned in some detail with the Italian case study, reactions against, you know, corrupt elites and the end of you know, particular phases of civilization is a kind of key theme or a key idea. But yeah, what is the role of experts? Both, I suppose, you know, being drawn upon by parties, right-wing figures and the public, but also, and you do this right towards the kind of the end of the book, what the sort of experts do in this context, in the context of social media, which may be, you know, highly distorting their ideas or, you know, sort of saying things that are demonstrably false based on their expertise.
Yes, this was very interesting to study. I looked at the kinds of sources that were mentioned in these social media texts that I looked at and how they were used to legitimize discourse about populist nationalist discourse, in essence. And what I could see very clearly is that, first of all, it's important to understand expertise as distributed. So to understand how and where it featured, because direct mentions of historians or archaeologists were very few. But particularly in the Italian case, there were quite a few mentions of what people had learned at school, what people had read in their school books, and then also mentions of television. Series, television programs, schools, education, formal education, and television were probably the most powerful sources of information that were mentioned. And of course, television programs and those that were referenced directly were programs where experts, historians did feature. So the book stresses how the power of these two ways of communicating scientific narratives, mediating scientific narratives, one through school education and the other through television. And when it comes to television in particular, there is a detailed analysis of the discourse that is put forward by experts on those programs and what we find, how we find it referenced by people in social media. And particularly very direct, very emotional accounts relating, for example, to invasions and how they were they contributed to the end of the Roman Empire were really felt by some of the viewers who wrote how upset they were, and how these really made them believe that immigrants coming to their country would effectively cause the end of the country. So there is a sensationalized way in which certain accounts were put forward really had a strong psychological impact on viewers, and an impact on what they believed. So that it was very clear that, yes, some of these myths, you know, myths of origin, myths of collapse, are have a long tradition. They stay, they endure. They've been there for a long time, but they've been played out in different ways, and they are almost filled by narratives that are still in part, we see, in the hands of experts, which is why we should really be careful in the way in which we present some of the information that we some of the interpretation that we develop through our research, if you like.
I mean, that's one of many insights that I think the book puts forward. And the book, as I mentioned at the start, is kind of essential reading for lots of different reasons. And one of the things that strikes me, you know, kind of in conclusion, is where you go next for this analysis and what kind of themes. Not just from this, you know, particular focus or case study of populist nationalism, but also actually where the methods and I guess where the kind of framework you've got in the book might go next.
Yes, at the end of this study, I really came to the conclusion that you know, weighing the pros and cons of adopting the kinds of methods that I did adopt, and focusing on an analysis of heritage values as they're put forward on social media, it is really worthwhile to pursue these kinds of big data-driven studies of interactions with the past through social media, despite their challenges. There are many challenges, because they can unlock insights that we could have not really developed by using more traditional forms of investigation. This idea that I was mentioning at the beginning of capturing rare moments when people use the past to describe how they see the present and how they see the future as well is really powerful and very, very informative. And going forward, it could be really interesting, and this is one of my plans, on the one end, to extend some of these investigations in a comparative way to different contexts, also beyond Europe and North America. But on the other, is to work with more those more traditional methods that I mentioned, still primarily quantitatively, in order to, for example, understand a little bit better how distributed expertise impacts on people's ideas of the past, which in turn impact on their ideas of the present and future. It's a bit of a sort of a circle. So these more quantitative, more, as I said, traditional studies, survey-based, could at this stage be informative about the relations between, for example, the use of different media sources and views about the past, the present, the future.
And another book?
Yes, potentially. It's something that I am starting to work on.